Park, 99.5 FM.
Here in New York City, you're tuned to 99.5 FM WBAI, WBAI.org on the web. It's 12 noon. Coming up next, The Gary Null Show.
Live from New York City, it's The Gary Null Show.
Your love lifting me higher.
And now, your host, Gary Null.
Everyone, I'm Gary Null. Nice to have you with us today. We're going to share a lot on how to turn off inflammation in the body, how to help your cells, and how you can live a longer life. And it starts with a Tabriz University study. They showed that in clinical experiments, black cumin seed oil, that's your nigella, N-I-G-E-L-L-A, sativa, S-A-T-I-V-A, can help treat hypothyroidism. Now, I can remember at the beginning of my career, virtually every holistic doctor, persons practicing holistic medicine at that time, was hypothyroidism and hypoglycemia. Those were the two things were the big deal. And they had different treatments for the thyroid gland. Well, consuming a few grams, a powdered black cumin seed oil, the liquid's a little hard to take, but the powder's easy. You end up taking in the black cumin seed in powder form, and it improves the autoimmune thyroid condition, and that's important. So this was published in the Journal of British Medical C, Complementary and Alternative Medicine. So if you have a thyroid problem, especially a low or underactive thyroid, take a look at black cumin seed powder. And it doesn't take a lot, just a few grams a day. All right. In fact, you don't want to overdo any treatment for the thyroid. Following the Mediterranean-style diet during pregnancy can reduce the risk of preeclampsia. This is a study from Johns Hopkins University. So following up, basically lots of vegetables, including purslane, lots of herbs. They use a lot of herbs, fresh herbs, not so much dried herbs in the Mediterranean area. Lots of fresh fruits and vegetables and beans. They're very big on beans. Almost every time I've eaten in an Italian person's home, they have some kind of bean dish, and they have some wonderful sauces. So they can use the same bean with 20 different sauces, and that's terrific. So make sure you're getting your beans, because it's a very important part. Now, they do have fish in the diet. Generally, that fish is fresh caught out of the Mediterranean. And they also consume small amounts of dairy, but their dairy is different. Frequently, it is from grass-fed cattle. They don't do the same approach to dairy as we do in the United States. They frequently make their own cheeses and fermented cheeses, like a kefir. And they have a lot of yogurt. So anyhow, it's not the best diet in the world. The plant-based, healthy, organic, locally grown diet, that would be number one. But it certainly is better than the average American or Western European diet. So following a Mediterranean-style diet during pregnancy was associated with the greatest reduction in risk. This was published in the Journal of the American Heart Association, preeclampsia. By the way, that's a condition during pregnancy characterized by severe high blood pressure and liver and kidney damage. It's a major cause of complications and death for the mother and their unborn child. And preeclampsia also increases a woman's risk of heart disease, like high blood pressure, heart attack, stroke, and heart failure, by more than 200%. All right, later in life. So women with preeclampsia have a higher risk of preterm delivery, meaning giving birth before 37 weeks gestation, or low birth weight babies who are more susceptible to dying, and children born to mothers with preeclampsia are also at higher risk of developing high blood pressure and heart disease. So if something as simple, as inexpensive, as a Mediterranean-style diet can help with all these conditions, then it's certainly worth doing. All right? So very important. Next up, University of Missouri. Individuals with type 2 diabetes, that's adult diabetes, should exercise after dinner. Yes, exercise is a popular prescription for individuals suffering from symptoms of type 2 diabetes, but there hasn't been a lot of research exploring whether these individuals receive more benefits from working out before or after dinner. Now, research at the University of Missouri has found that individuals with type 2 diabetes can lower your risk of cardiovascular disease more effectively by exercising after a meal. That's important. This was done at the Department of Nutrition, Exercise, Physiology. So the results that they're claiming show that it has the most powerful effect on reducing glucose, that's your blood sugar, and fat levels in your blood. You don't want a lot of fat circulating in your blood, because when you have a lot of fat circulating in the blood, that's a problem. That means that red blood cells can stick to that fat and cause a aggregation and a clumping, and that can block an artery. So, good news. Now, I suggest that after you eat, that you go for a walk. And not a fast walk, but just a moderate walk for about 20 minutes. That will substantially help to stimulate your metabolism. It will help speed up digestion and elimination. There's an interesting study out of Tufts University. They found that when you consume the pulp of fruit, and let's say you juice an orange, well, you got pulp left over, and that's rich in polyphenols and other bioactive antioxidants and anti-inflammatory phytochemicals. It can help reverse age-related cognitive decline. This was in a laboratory experiment. So my suggestion is that when you eat an orange, eat the whole orange. And when you juice a lemon, juice the whole lemon, including the skin and the fibrous material underneath, which contains the bioflavonoids. That white pulp in the citrus is very healing, very healthy. All right? Especially if you have cognition. That's what the study showed. Now, we've been doing superfoods. We've got another one today, the peppers. Why? Because in that pepper, you have a chemical called capsicum, C-A-P-S-I-C-U-M. If you look back in Native American folk medicine, which has so many features we can still learn from and benefit from today, like echinacea, all right, it shows a very prominent place in its pharmacology. And peppers, especially in the capsicum family, those are the ones that are, you know, have the fire to them. Those include bell peppers and chili peppers, jalapeno peppers, probably the best example. Recent work suggests that the nutrient capsicum found in those peppers is a natural analgesic and a neuroinflammatory blocker that relieves aches and pains in your joints and muscles. This is one reason why Native American medicine prescribed a topical application of pepper to painful areas of the body. And capsicum comes in creams also. And so it needs to be mentioned that look for the creams that have capsicum as a primary ingredient. Also, there's been a lot of work on the benefits of prostate cancer and leukemia in capsicum. And so that can help. It also helps with weight loss. It stimulates insulin-producing cells, and it prevents the LDL cholesterol oxidation. Another benefit recently uncovered is that the nutrient protects from stomach ulceration and induces programmed cell death in lung cancer. So setting aside the value of capsicum, peppers can also be prized because they're rich sources of vitamin A, B1, B6, vitamin E, and K. They're also good for potassium, magnesium, and iron. And yellow peppers, yeah, we should be eating them too. They're rich in lutein and xanthine, which protect your eyes from disease and blindness. That's the latest on health and healing. A little shorter today because I wanted to take a break and come back and share something that's going to take a little longer. Remember, go to GaryNall.com and you see all these different tabs. There's one tab, for example, that shows all the third-person acknowledgments of what I've done in my life. For example, just one example, it shows the physicians, the journalists, the patients who I work with over a 20-year period. I still work with people today, but then it was large groups, 1,200 people, helping them with AIDS, and shows the treatments that benefited them and the cures. And so it's not me saying, it's them. It also shows all the athletic records, athlete of the year, year after year, in New York and in Florida, etc. Still competing, still trying to break some records coming up in a month from now. And it shows it. It's not me saying it. You see the records, you actually see the videos of those races, including setting a world record. And the World Games, up on the stand in the middle of the stadium, as you see, those are not fake, those are real. But more importantly, it shows the work I've done in investigative journalism, environmental sciences, and in conservation, organic farming, as a gourmet vegan chef. It shows all these different things in 14 different careers. All right? So it's all there. None of it me saying it. Now, I've never done this in my 55-year career, but because the attacks from Wikipedia, I chose to put these up there to show you the truth, who I am. And then you can also go to About Gary, and that's photographs of my whole career. So I walk it and I talk it. All right? There's no contradiction there. We're going to take a break and come back with a lot of important information. Please stay with us. Welcome back, everyone. I'm Gary Nall. Now we're going to take you to three clips, and these are very important. I'm not doing a daily program on Ukraine. That's not my focus. However, when I see so much misinformation being dispensed by virtually every government and institutional and media spokesperson, I believe it's important to share some balance. Now, the overview is that Ukraine should never have been involved in this action with Russia. Russia should not have invaded and caused all these unnecessary and preventable deaths and destruction. Therefore, they will have to be held accountable and should be held accountable for those actions. However, this is where you got a double negative, because we've been led to believe that this just happened out of the blue, unprovoked. You know, the Ukrainians were just not doing anything wrong, and they were attacked. That's not true. This could have all been prevented. But it wasn't, because it wasn't in the interest of the United States and its geopolitical partners and the neocons. They need wars. They profit from wars or the threat of wars. They base their profit stream on creating fear, weapons of mass destruction. You know, the domino theory in Vietnam. You know, the if we don't kill them over in Afghanistan, the Taliban are going to come here. Lie after lie. Assad, weapons of mass destruction in the form of chemical weapons, using it all on his own people. Not true. Never happened. And that was independently shown, but the media never apologized. They're still using those lies. You know, Gaddafi represents a threat only to the value of the dollar, but he was the most important asset in all of Africa. But that's the truth, and we don't like that if it challenges our prevailing sense of reality. So what I'm going to share with you now is probably the best explanation and the best historical reference to understand how we got here. Okay? It's not an apology for Russia and Putin. You've heard me say many times he should be held accountable for crimes against humanity. But this didn't have to happen, and there was a civil war going on for the past 8 years, and that civil war came because there was a coup that cost $5 billion of our money, and it was done by Barack Obama and Hillary Clinton and Gloria Nuland, plus all the neocons they associate with, where they chose, and we have all the evidence, because we have the actual phone conversations between the U.S. Ambassador to Ukraine and Gloria Nuland, Under Secretary of State for Ukraine at the State Department, planning on who would be ousted, who would be put in place, who we could control. And that's exactly what happened. But here's an interview, and I'm not going through the background now. I don't want to waste any more time. Yeah, you'll see who they are. A person, an American journalist, who's been in Ukraine because he married a Ukrainian woman for the past 8 years. And he's right in the front lines. He's extremely heroic. He does the best war reporting I've seen in the world. I mean, he is courageous. If you watch the videos, he's got a lot of them up there. I mean, he's dodging bullets. And he's right in the front lines. He's not safely back somewhere or embedded. So he's giving us the truth. Also, on an upcoming episode, I'll show you videos of who killed all those civilians in these communities and who blew up the buildings. It was the Azov, or the neo-fascist Ukrainian divisions. And the media in America won't report that. So now for the best history lesson, to give you a real perspective on how we got here and where we're at.
On the streets of Donbass, Ukraine.
Right now, I'm in center Donetsk. Donetsk is the capital of the anti-Ukraine government, Donetsk People's Republic, one of the two that just was recognized by Russia.
Okay.
Not long before the war, or this part of the war started.
Yeah. How long have you been in this area?
Most of the last 8 years. Because the war has been going on for almost 8 years now. And I came here just before the war started. Officially, the day is May 26, 2014, is when the real fighting started here in Donetsk, in the Donetsk airport. And I got here in April, just after the events in Crimea and the referendum down there.
What brought you to that area of Ukraine?
I had been traveling around Europe, doing some stuff as a photographer, not too much, just kind of more artsy stuff than actual news things. And I ended up in Greece when there was some unrest going, and kind of got an enjoyment out of showing some news that wasn't getting shown in other places. And then actually when Maidan started, I had heard about a little what was going on, but I wasn't really in the politics of it, of between Russia and Europe and Ukraine at that point. But I was seeing some interesting photos coming out, and I thought, oh, that might be interesting to see what's really going on. But then it kind of fizzled down. And then once Crimea started to develop, I decided, okay, you know, I want to go there and kind of check it out and see what the real situation is with my own eyes, and see if I can help share some of that information. And I got to Crimea, and I really saw a big difference in what was being shown in the Western media and what was actually going on. I mean, before I got there, I saw that, you know, the media was making it seem like, you know, Russia was trying to make the locals in Crimea become more towards Russia and part of Russia. But once I got there, I just saw, you know, the overwhelming support and just, you know, sea of Russian flags and everything. And just, you know, that virtually almost every single person was for Russia and becoming part of Russia. I mean, the people that were born there before 1956 were born in Russia. So it just makes sense to them to go back. And then once was there for the referendum, and then once that kind of fizzled off and started calming down, once, you know, Russia was in, and, you know, it was a done deal pretty much. Then Donetsk started to develop. So I ended up going to Donetsk here and staying, showing the referendum here as well. Again, how it's a lot different than the West was making it out to seem, you know, seeing the fact that there's no Ukrainian language spoken here. There's, you know, the vast majority of the population is ethnically Russian, and they all, you know, would like to consider this, you know, this area part of Russia. I mean, they definitely do now. At that point, it was still kind of back and forth. You know, they're forming the DPR, the Donetsk People's Republic. Well, I don't know if you heard that. That was just a little bit of shelling coming from the edge of the city.
Do you feel relatively safe going about your day? Or, I mean, are you, every day are you pretty worried about your safe of your family, your wife, your children? You know, how does that work for you?
Okay, we're here in the center, and we're, you know, staying for the very safe as possible. Even though I go to the front every day to report, you know, we still, you know, take precautions and things. I mean, there at the beginning of the war, we were putting the mattresses up against the windows and things just to stay safe, but we're taking all precautions.
Now, you said the vast majority of people there are ethnically Russian, you know, there's Russian flags, people are speaking Russian. What about the Ukrainian people there? I mean, is there a small minority of, you know, local Ukrainians that also live there? And when that switched and it went, you know, when it officially turned to Russia, how was the local sentiment? Was a lot of people happy about that? And then how about that for the local Ukrainians that were there? I know that there's still some say that were speaking Ukrainian or that are ethnically Ukrainian. How did they feel? Did they move out of that region or are they still there? How does that work?
Well, yeah, there's definitely a minority of other people besides the ethnically Russian, even not only Ukrainians. There's the Crimean Tatars as well. But as far as the Ukrainians, they still all speak Russian, and they did before the referendum and Russia taking over. Some of them did choose to leave, like some of the police force and, you know, the military that was there. Not all of the military, but it was kind of an interesting time because the Crimean switched over without, you know, any real, you know, wars. I mean, absolutely no war down there. It was a few shots here and there with, you know, some of the bases and things. But, I mean, for all intents and purposes, Crimea made a turnover without any real fighting. And people were free to leave if they wanted, to stay if they wanted. Okay. And all people who stayed were able to get Russian citizenship. And yes, the people were extremely happy. And I've gone back to Crimea every year. Well, except for 2020. every year besides that, back to Crimea. For one, to do a little reportage and see how the situation is, and just to have a little vacation in the summer as well, because of really amazing beaches there, just right. Really a nice place.
So basically what you're saying is when that switched over to officially becoming part of Russia, there really wasn't, you know, a lot of turmoil there. Most of the people there were ethnically Russian. They were able to get Russian citizenship. Everyone there speaks Russian already. So it's a very easy transition, more or less. And right now it's been pretty peaceful over the last few years in Crimea. You go back every summer, nice beaches, nice holiday. So that's a good insight, I think, for people better understanding that. Tell us more about this eastern part of Ukraine, you know, the Donbas region that we hear about, because we know that there has been a lot of conflict there for the past 8 years. And I think it's a very similar setup. Is it right? You know, similar to Crimea, there's a tremendous amount of ethnic Russians. You know, mostly Russian language is being spoken in this region. Do you see a similar sentiment where people are wanting to have the same thing as Crimea? Right? Would they want to be part of Russia? They want to be cut off from Ukraine and part of the Russian Republic?
Well, I will tell you with one thing. The locals that live here do not consider this part of eastern Ukraine anymore. Yeah, that's something that kind of went out the window after the referendum 8 years ago, and especially now that all this new developments are happening, especially with the recognition from Russia. And over the last 2 years, Russia has been issuing Russian passports and citizenships to the locals here. So, Yeah, I mean, these people have been living under 8 years of war. That's what a lot of people in the West don't realize is, Russia is invading Ukraine right now, but that's not the start of the war. The war started in 2014, and these people here in Donetsk have been under intense attack year after year from Ukrainian territory. They've been fighting back, of course, but, I mean, they started this with protests in 2014 after Maidan and after Crimea, and a lot of them hoped and prayed that after seeing what happened in Crimea, that Russia was able to, you know, absorb Crimea again. They thought the same thing was going to happen here. Once they did their referendum, they put up their borders. But unfortunately, once they did all that, they put up their borders, Ukraine said, no, we're not going to let that fly. And this 8-year war ensued with thousands and thousands of civilians dying. I mean, I've been working here on this side of the contact line in the anti-Ukraine government territory, so I've only been able to show what happens here. But what I've seen here with my own eyes is indiscriminate shelling of civilian areas year after year by Ukrainian forces. It could indiscriminate and targeted, in fact. Just last month, there was two electric plants, civilian electric plants targeted by Ukraine forces. Now that the war is really hot, attacks are coming in every hour. The only thing that's being shown in the West is the results of Russian attacks on Ukraine. But what the West isn't showing is every day here in Donetsk, there is attacks from Ukraine-controlled territory, Ukraine attacking the civilian population here. In the last 12 days, there's been 19 civilians killed. I mean, it's not a huge amount like across Ukraine right now, but in the last 12 days in the Donetsk People's Republic-controlled territory, there's been 19 civilians killed, and I believe 27 injured. And these are results of Ukrainian attacks on mostly civilian areas. Of course, battle has been raging on the front line since this new development happened and even before. A lot of the shells are hitting civilian areas, and I assume a lot are hitting military areas as well. Those aren't as free to report on as the other ones. But I'm hitting the front every day, showing what I can of the situation. That's what the West doesn't realize, is the effect the toll has taken on the people here in Donetsk and across this whole what they call what the West calls the Eastern Ukraine area. The civilian population, there's still some on the streets here, walking. I'm in the center of Donetsk, but these people are war hardened. I'm not sure if you can notice from afar, but most of the people that are walking around now are all women, children, or elderly, because all the men of military age have been mobilized to go to the war. This isn't just the Russian military that's at this war. The entire male population of these republics, both the Donetsk and Luhansk People's Republics, have been mobilized, or you can say drafted or conscripted, or however you want to put it, to go to the front and fight. These people are really under a huge amount. And there's been a mass evacuation, whereas a lot of the civilians have evacuated, the women, children, and elderly. The latter still here. They didn't want to leave without their men, but a lot of evacuated.
No, we really appreciate your insights into the region. Now, when you say that the locals have been, all of the men that are in fighting age have been recruited, now are you saying that they're now fighting for Russia and they're in fact...
That puts a lot in perspective, doesn't it? Now we're going to hear from Sana Saeed, a Backspace. This is one of the most honest and revealing discussions I've ever heard about the truth of what really went on in Afghanistan for 20 years and how the American media portrayed us of freeing the women, liberating them, bringing peace and prosperity to Afghanistan. It's not true. And remember, why is this important? Because the very people telling us what to do now in Ukraine, and that we must keep giving weapons to Ukraine and money to Ukraine, and we're not to criticize the corrupt president who arrested and jailed his opposition and took over all the media and shut down all the media that didn't support him, and where he got his million-dollar homes in Miami and in other places. Now, we're not to criticize any of that or the administrations that backed all this nonsense. No, we're just go ahead and support it. Support the war machine. These are the same people who told us all this about Afghanistan and Iraq. They've lied nonstop.
Imagine a huge dark piece of cloth hung over your entire body like you were a shameful statue. That is an excerpt from the poem Under the Burqa by the playwright formerly known as Eve Ensler. It was recited by Oprah Winfrey on February 10th, 2001 in front of 18,000 people who had paid $1,000 per ticket to attend a Vagina Monologues gala event. They then witnessed Winfrey remove a blue shuttlecock burqa from an Afghan activist. That was 8 months before the invasion of Afghanistan. There isn't a better summary of over 20 years of U.S. involvement in Afghanistan than that. An exorbitantly expensive spectacle of salvation and dehumanization using the body of the Afghan woman as a front. It also sums up what U.S. coverage of Afghanistan has looked like for over two decades.
For the women of Afghanistan, the veil, the burqa, has become the symbol of the Taliban's power.
How long does the military think it will take them to finish the job that they came there to do in terms of Afghanistan and Al-Qaeda and the Taliban?
Hundreds of women, many in burqas, gathered at a wedding hall to implore officials to find a kidnapped American aid worker.
For the first time, hitting the Taliban where it hurts, targeting the drug labs that double as money machines for the insurgency.
With the Taliban seizing power, the fate of Afghan women and girls hangs in the balance, as do hard-fought freedoms and rights.
In its coverage of Afghanistan, the U.S. media has tightly held hands with U.S. foreign policy, helping justify an invasion born in large part out of the fog of vengeance following the 9/11 attacks. And so when we closely examine American media coverage of Afghanistan from the invasion to the occupation, even the withdrawal in late 2021, we see how U.S. militarism and, in many cases, U.S. journalists themselves are presented as a source of salvation. Afghanistan deserves a better story, and for us here to tell that story from the vantage point of the American empire, we need to be able to re-examine how we've built the narratives around American militarism, its victims, and the so-called war on terror. We need to define the real legacy the United States leaves in Afghanistan, one which is about the horrors of violence and not one about a reluctant savior, a bumbling empire. Welcome to Backspace, where we tell you how the story is told in our headlines, and then we think about how we can tell it differently. The narrative U.S. coverage of Afghanistan loves to repeat, as it often does in coverage of Muslim societies, is about the physical bodies of the women and the violence done against them by their own men, while actively ignoring the role American militarism plays.
The Taliban, of course, is responding in the way that it always has, that Osama bin Laden and his associates are guests in their country. Well, it's time for the guests to leave.
It is obviously late in the evening in Kabul, and once again, they are finding nighttime very unpleasant.
As we drive out the Taliban and the terrorists, we're determined to lift up the people of Afghanistan. The women and children of Afghanistan have suffered enough.
Afghan women were and still are depicted as simply victims of their men's savagery. They only exist in our headlines when they're being beaten by their own men, denied education by their own men, or when they're killed by their own men. And journalists, of course, have made themselves the voice of Afghan women against their own men.
The hidden victims of war and a brutal male-dominated society, a rare look inside the lives of Afghan women and their struggle to survive.
The need for female officers is definitely there, but you can imagine the incredible obstacles and taboos that Afghan women have to get through in order to do this kind of work.
Violence towards women is not just committed by the Taliban, and it's quite frequent. And in a report released just this year by Human Rights Watch, it stated that nearly 9 out of 10 Afghan women suffer physical, sexual, or psychological violence or forced marriage at least once in their lifetimes.
Rarely, if ever, do we hear about how the women of Afghanistan have been impacted by over 20 years of American militarism and occupation. Instead, we see blame placed primarily on culture, on tribes, implying that this violence and hatred of women is simply a part of a rough terrain where men rule and women serve. But how did severe U.S. economic sanctions, which have been used against Afghanistan since 1999, impact women? The healthcare system, maternal healthcare. How did over 20 years of American military occupation, drones, war crimes, misuse of funds, and failed institutional building impact the economic, political, and physical well-being of women? U.S. coverage shows us that violence against Afghan women only exists at the hands of their own men and never ours. Ours are there to help. But shouldn't U.S. coverage hold the actions of its government accountable? Shouldn't U.S. coverage look at its government's complicity in worsening conditions for Afghan women? Journalists seemed pretty excited to start the war to save them, but not as much when the time came to hold their own governments accountable. This was nowhere more apparent than in the coverage of the U.S. exit from Afghanistan in August 2021. A long-planned but haphazard violent withdrawal led to a sudden increase in concern and horror amongst American news punditry and reporters about the well-being of Afghan women.
With the Taliban in control, Afghanistan's women and girls now find themselves fearing that 20 years of progress will vanish.
Afghan women, do you worry that they were abandoned by the United States, essentially?
The most vulnerable are little Afghan girls. What are you hearing? Are Afghan girls able to get out?
Many American journalists seemed shocked that 20 years of well-documented corruption and destabilization didn't result in Afghanistan turning into a liberal Western democracy, that it fell apart so quickly. We saw blame put on President Joe Biden for failing the people, and specifically the women of Afghanistan, by leaving them at the mercy of the Taliban.
Did you get the sense that President Biden cared about the fate of Afghan women?
I don't think so. He said U.S. could not be the police of the world to protect women in any other country.
If there was a frustration by President Biden that staying wasn't going to help things, we've now seen that leaving can make things worse.
Many journalists began to see themselves as saviors, imperfect, but saviors nevertheless, taking up the responsibility of demanding that something be done to protect Afghan women. And then there was the glorification of American militarism. We were inundated with feel-good stories, tweets, and photos about U.S. soldiers and Afghan children, where the occupier was, again, portrayed as a savior and ultimately a good-hearted person because they were on our side. They represent us.
This is what American troops were doing before terrorists struck today. Feeding children, playing with kids, lending an arm to the elderly. The American military is the greatest in the world, not only because of its superior force, but because of its humanity.
Now, compare that to what felt like silence from the same American newsrooms once it began to be reported that over 23 million Afghans were facing mass starvation, with only 2% of the population having the means to feed themselves sufficiently, that the winter was about to claim countless lives. But that level of devastation wasn't from a natural disaster. We knew a famine was approaching in Afghanistan as early as March 2021. The famine has been made a lot worse by Joe Biden's decision to freeze $7 billion in assets from Afghanistan's central bank. That was justified as a way to coerce the Taliban, which retook the country as the U.S. withdrew, into meeting U.S. and European demands. In one of the few instances where the connection was made between the frozen money and the devastation it caused, The Intercept's Austin Allman detailed what the U.S. move has actually meant, that it's kept Afghans from withdrawing their own money, that teachers and government workers are unable to receive their salaries, that the impact the freeze has had on the import-export trade is devastating the economy. Most coverage doesn't actually connect the dots between the U.S. decision to freeze funds and the humanitarian crisis. If it did, the picture would show a starvation campaign waged by the United States on the country it supposedly went to war to save. Usually, the frozen funds are buried deep into articles that offer little context beyond painting the Taliban as primarily to blame for the hunger. The framing makes it seem like freezing the money was the logical thing to do, to stop the money from getting into the hands of the Taliban.
The United States continues to face difficult fundamental questions about how it might be able to make reserve funds available to directly benefit the people of Afghanistan while ensuring that the funds do not benefit the Taliban.
It can be spun any way, but that won't change the fact that by freezing those assets, the United States enacted a policy of mass starvation. And yet, there seems to be less media concern about Afghan women and girls having enough food to eat than there is about what clothes they have to wear. Take the Wall Street Journal, for example. Between August 1st, 2021 and February 16th of this year, the journal posted over a dozen articles, podcasts, and videos about the dangers facing Afghan women from Afghan men and from the Taliban. And articles and podcasts on the famine and the starvation facing millions of Afghans? A handful. Even then, reports weren't framed around the direct impact of the U.S. freeze. Coverage in the New York Times follows a similar suit, where stories about Afghan women outnumber those specifically about the deteriorating situation in Afghanistan and the U.S. role in exacerbating it. Now, on February 11th, President Joe Biden made the announcement that the $7 billion would finally be unfrozen, but it wouldn't be given back to Afghans. Instead, half of it would be given in aid, meaning distributed by U.S.-approved organizations. The other half, the Biden administration has decided that it will keep the money for itself, putting it in a compensation fund for victims of 9/11, meaning further punishment for a crime that Afghanistan never committed but has paid for two decades, meaning Afghans are paying reparations to citizens of the richest country in the world while they are being starved. But Sana, can we really talk about Afghanistan differently? Are you saying we can't talk about Afghan women? This is sounding like whataboutism and Taliban apologia to me. We absolutely can, should be talking about Afghanistan completely differently. Demands for more humane and honest reporting that holds American war crimes and occupation accountable can be uncomfortable for many. It is, after all, easier to frame the United States ultimately as good but bumbling, and just blame the scary brown-bearded Muslim men for everything that's gone wrong. So where do we start? How can we as journalists talk about Afghanistan, especially in its current situation, in a way that is humane and honest? We start with defining the actual legacy of the U.S. war in Afghanistan, and we begin that with the violence that is at its heart. Instead of using this moment following the U.S. exit to earnestly self-reflect on the criminal excesses of the war, on the toll it took on the people of Afghanistan, the American media collectively erased 20 years of history and rewrote the narrative to make the U.S. into a restrained savior. The U.S. presence in Afghanistan didn't begin in 2001, but that's a good day to start. The single greatest source of violence in Afghanistan over the last 20 years comes from the presence of U.S. war and occupation. Rural Afghanistan, which is where the majority of Afghans lived, has been devastated by the occupation, which has seen drone air wars claim many lives, including of men and boys who have been indiscriminately and without contention or evidence labeled enemy combatants. Then there is the question of violence against women in Afghanistan. There are cruel realities for Afghan women. Our job isn't to deny that. Our coverage, however, needs to take into account how 40 years of war and 20 years of military occupation creates a culture of violence. What it does to a society. When violence is normalized at every major level, then it is normalized in the most private of spaces as well. Generations of Afghans, boys and girls, men and women, have gone through four decades of horrific violence, often related to foreign invasions, which disrupts not only institutions, but also a country's cultural fabric and its interpersonal relationships. When we chalk everything up to "that's their culture," we have removed any and all responsibility of our government and 20 years of context we, as the media, are also responsible for because of the dehumanizing coverage of the people of Afghanistan. Another way of reckoning with the U.S. legacy in Afghanistan is to be clear that there was no nation building, just like there was no saving of women or building of democracy. What we continue to refer to as a nation building project, creating institutions to better the day-to-day lives of Afghans, was actually billions of dollars pumped unchecked into the hands of corrupt Afghan government officials, Northern Virginia defense contractors, warlords, or it just disappeared. Then there's talking to Afghans, not just those with families who worked with past governments or those who have worked with the U.S. military as contractors or those who live in Kabul. Afghanistan is home to over 38 million people, 74% of whom live in rural areas. Yet interviews with Afghans focus on major city centers or the diaspora. And when the U.S. war in particular has disproportionately impacted Afghans in rural areas, shouldn't they be at the center of the stories? I have to say that there is good reporting from many U.S. journalists. Their work, while functioning as the exception to how mainstream U.S. media has covered Afghanistan, offers that better and honest coverage that reckons with this country's legacy of violence is possible.
Do you believe in freedom of choice? Do you believe in freedom of speech? Do you believe that people should have an opportunity in the public forum to debate and dialogue in a civil manner their different points of view? I do. That's why I allow this forum to be used to share points of view. I may disagree with the people on many issues, but if they have something I think is important, then I'll bring them on, and then we'll offer a legitimate challenge in a polite manner. Well, here is Kim Iverson talking about how Noam Chomsky, the absolute top respected person on the left for decades, is now being absolutely butchered by the entire left because he dared say something that was different than their talking notes about war, arm, fight, have the Ukrainians fight to the last person. Yeah, that's stupid. It's vile. It's moronic. It shows a complete disconnect from reality. Noam Chomsky got it right on this. Let's hear what Kim has to say and why we in the United States now are turning on the people, the very people that they surrounded in decades as being truthful, but now suddenly he's a liar or he's suffering from cognitive decline? No. No, it shows you how far, unfortunately, the liberal media has gone from honoring the liberal principles.
Kim, what's on your radar?
Well, famed leftist icon Noam Chomsky started trending on social media after he upset liberals for saying Ukraine should negotiate with Russia rather than fight in a bloody war. Noam first sat down with Nathan J. Robinson from Current Affairs, where he said, quote, in this world, there are two options with regard to Ukraine. As we know, one option is a negotiated settlement, which will offer Putin an escape, an ugly settlement. Is it within reach? We don't know. You can only find out by trying, and we're refusing to try, but that's one option. The other option is to make it explicit and clear to Putin and the small circle of men around him that you have no escape. You're going to go to war crimes trial no matter what you do. Boris Johnson just reiterated this. Sanctions will go on no matter what you do. What does that mean? It means go ahead and obliterate Ukraine and go on to lay the basis for a terminal war. Those are the two options, and we're picking the second and praising ourselves for heroism and doing it, fighting Russia to the last Ukrainian. He reiterated these sentiments while talking with Jeremy Scahill from The Intercept.
The right question is, what is the best thing to do to save Ukraine from a grim fate, from further destruction, and that's to move towards a negotiated settlement. There are some simple facts that aren't really controversial. There are two ways for a war to end. One way is for one side or the other to be basically destroyed, and the Russians are not going to be destroyed. So that means one way is for Ukraine to be destroyed. The other way is some negotiated settlement. If there's a third way, no one's ever figured it out. So what we should be doing is devoting all the things you mentioned, if properly shaped, but primarily moving towards a possible negotiated settlement that will save Ukrainians from further disaster.
Now, in both interviews, he quotes respected veteran diplomat and former U.S. Assistant Secretary of Defense Chaz Freeman, who said the U.S.'s policy is not to negotiate, but to fight to the last Ukrainian. Chomsky said in his interview with Current Affairs, "I don't know if you saw it, but a couple of days ago, there was a very important interview by one of the most astute and respected figures in current U.S. diplomatic circles, Ambassador Chaz Freeman, a very important interview. He pointed out that the current U.S. policy, which he bitterly criticized, is to fight Russia to the last Ukrainian, and he gave us an example, President Biden's heroic statement about the war criminal Putin, Biden's counterpart, as a war criminal. And Freeman pointed out the obvious. The U.S. is setting things up so as to destroy Ukraine and lead to a terminal war." Well, the very important interview Noam Chomsky is referring to is one in which Chaz Freeman sat down with Aaron Maté from the Gray Zone back in late March.
But we don't know where this is going, and more to the point, the United States is not part of any effort to negotiate an end to the fighting. To the extent that there is mediation going on, it seems to be by Turkey, possibly Israel, maybe China, and that's about it. The United States is not in the room. Everything we are doing, rather than accelerating an end to the fighting and some compromise, seems to be aimed at prolonging the fighting, assisting the Ukrainian resistance, which is a noble cause, I suppose, but it will result in a lot of dead Ukrainians as well as dead Russians. Zelensky is obviously a very intelligent man, and he saw what the consequences of being put in what he called limbo would be. Namely, Ukraine would be hung out to dry. And the West was basically saying, we will fight to the last Ukrainian for Ukrainian independence, which essentially remains our stand. It's pretty cynical.
Chaz Freeman also talks about something Chomsky is experiencing right now, being labeled a Putin puppet for calling for peace.
I know people who have been attempting to be objective about this, and they're immediately accused of being Russian agents, or that is to say, the price of speaking on this subject is to join the pom-pom girls in a frenzy of support for our position. If you're not part of the chorus, you're not allowed to say anything, and you can't sing. So I think that this has had very injurious effects on Western liberties. And it has enforced an almost, I won't say it's totalitarian, but it's certainly similar kind of control on freedom of expression and inquiry in the West. It's very depressing, really.
So, Ryan and Robbie, I mean, there's definitely a problem here, you know, that Chaz Freeman, I think, is bringing up of, you know, if you say anything other than just fight, fight, fight until the last Ukrainian, then you're labeled a Putin puppet. But one thing Noam said in his interviews is there's a difference between being rational and being humane. And he says, you know, you might think it's rational for Ukraine to continue fighting. Like, for example, of course, they have the right to defend themselves. No one is saying they don't have that right. Do they have a right to American and Western weapons and, you know, constant stream of weaponry? That's a discussion to have, but they absolutely have the right to defend themselves. But what is humane for the Ukrainian people? That is a bigger question in this battle. And so, you know, but it's interesting that Noam Chomsky is just getting eviscerated. It just kind of shows me that there's so much about what is traditionally liberal values that seem to have just been, they're just deteriorating. I mean, just free, you know, lack of censorship. Right now you've got so many liberals championing censorship. You have liberals championing big tech and big pharma. And now even the military-industrial complex is saying, yeah, we need more war, more war, more war. So it's like amazing to me, this kind of transformation that's been happening over the years. But, you know, Ryan, what is your take on
that? Your thoughts. We're going to take a break. Come back. 888-874-4888. 888-874-4888. We'll have Richard Gale on to share his thoughts as well. Please stay with us.
From WPFW in Washington and WBAI in New York, I'm Sue Goodwin. Here are some headlines. Russia declared victory in the Ukrainian port city of Mariupol today, despite continued resistance from more than 2,000 Ukrainian fighters hunkered down in a steel plant. In a meeting aired today on state television, President Vladimir Putin instructed his defense officials to call off a storming of the steel plant in order to preserve what he called the life and health of our soldiers and officers. Putin ordered a blockade of the plant and repeated his call for the Ukrainian troops to surrender. The order comes as Russia seeks to free up more soldiers for its offensive along the war's eastern front. Controlling Mariupol gives Russia access to a key southern port along the Black Sea and connects its forces in annexed Crimea with its main army in the east. The Justice Department on Wednesday filed an appeal that seeks to reverse a judge's recent ruling that ended the nation's mask mandate on public transit. At issue is whether the CDC, during a public health emergency, has the authority to issue such an order. The CDC said it had asked the Justice Department to proceed with the appeal and that, quote, an order requiring masking in the indoor transportation corridor remains necessary for the public health, close quote. The CDC also stated it believes the order is lawful and well within CDC's legal authority to protect public health. The Florida Department of Health on Wednesday released guidelines that advise against treatment of gender dysphoria for people under the age of 18, including surgery as well as the prescription of hormone therapy or puberty blockers. Florida's updated guidance also said social transition strategies, such as using a different name or pronouns, should not be a treatment option. The guidance goes directly against federal HHS advice that says research demonstrates that medical care, like hormonal therapy, can vastly improve the lives and well-being of transgender and gender nonconforming youths. Daniel Tilley, the legal director of the ACLU of Florida, said in a statement that while Florida's guidance is non-binding and currently not enforceable, quote, we know that the impact will stoke fear among transgender youth, their parents, and their health care providers, close quote. In more news from Florida, the state's Senate passed a new congressional map drawn by the governor's staff that favors Republicans and eliminates two districts represented by Black Democrats. The Florida House is expected to pass the map today, and Governor DeSantis is considered certain to sign it. If it is adopted into law, the Florida map will likely face legal challenges from Democrats who maintain it violates the state's constitution and the Voting Rights Act's prohibition on racial gerrymandering. However, any successful legal challenge would probably not arrive in time for the November elections. And Representative Marjorie Taylor Greene of Georgia is set to testify tomorrow in a case seeking to disqualify her from re-election. Free Speech for People filed the challenge on behalf of a group of voters. The suit claims Greene cannot run for office again due to her alleged role in facilitating the January 6 attack on the Capitol, which Greene denies. The suit cited a provision in the 14th Amendment barring people from serving in Congress if they swore to support the Constitution but, quote, engaged in insurrection or rebellion, unquote, against the United States government. The amendment was ratified after the Civil War to prevent lawmakers who fought for the Confederacy from being elected to Congress again. Green will be the first member of Congress to be questioned about the January 6 riot under oath. From WPFW in Washington and WBAI in New York, I'm Sue Goodwin.
Meetings of Pacifica Foundation Radio's Board of Directors and all of its standing committees, including WBAI's local station board and community advisory board, are open to the public. WBAI board and committee meetings and community advisory board meetings are posted in the events calendar of WBAI's homepage at least 1 week in advance of the scheduled date and announced on the air. In addition, all Pacifica Foundation radio meetings are posted at Pacifica.org under calendar, with links to audio streams carrying telephonic meetings and audio recordings of those meetings. If a meeting is closed to the public, a written explanation of the reason for closing will accompany the meeting's minutes, available at Pacifica.org under calendar. If you want to be notified of meetings personally, please submit your email address to meetings at WBAI.org or call WBAI at 347-335-0633 during business hours.